Welcome to our podcast series, Elected Ed, in which we talk about issues affecting the everyday governing environment for local elected officials throughout North Carolina. We're coming to you from our studio here at the UNC School of Government in Chapel Hill. I'm Patrice Rossler, Manager of Elected Official Programming here with the school's Center for Public Leadership and Governance. Today, I'm joined by Katherine Johnson, Director of the Guilford County Family Justice Center, and Guilford County Commissioner Katie Cashin. We're talking about building connections. Specifically, we're discussing the Guilford County Connect to Protect program. Commissioner Cashin, thank you for joining us. You just said that you've been a commissioner for 19 years. Am I right?
You are correct.
That's a definite commitment to public service, Katie. Thank you. And Katherine, you've been director of the Family Justice Center for almost a decade now. Do you want to say a few words about what the Family Justice Center is?
Of course, yes. Hello, everyone. I'm Katherine Johnson. I've been with Guilford County since 2014 when our community was really planning the implementation of our Family Justice Center. Much of that work was led by Commissioner Cashin, so I'm honored to be joined with her today for this conversation. The Family Justice Center is one place. It's a one-stop shop for those experiencing child abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault, elder abuse, and stalking. And we're like an umbrella. We bring together a lot of different community agencies, including law enforcement and social workers and medical staff and attorneys who all work in one place so that when someone is experiencing a crisis or needs help, they come through one door and we connect them to the resources that they wish to receive.
Thank you, Katherine. Let's explore what the Connect to Protect initiative is. What is that program?
So we've worked with the School of Government, who's had quite a large emphasis on creating elder abuse multidisciplinary teams across the state of North Carolina. And I think Guilford County's is one of the oldest. We actually call our local program our Elder Justice Committee. And that is a multi-agency committee of professionals that include law enforcement, aging care professionals, ombudsmen through the Area Agency on Aging, social workers, attorneys, who all work together and meet monthly and do education, resources, and strategize ways to improve our community's response to elder abuse. And that work has been happening since the Family Justice Center opened our doors in 2015.
I was reading something from the U.S. Bureau of the Census just recently that by 2035 in North Carolina, we're going to have more older adults, and by that 65 or older, then we have young people. And I'm wondering if you are experiencing that kind of aging population in Guilford.
We are definitely seeing a rise in the aging population, the wise ones in our community. And we see those trends not only in folks that are living here, but we've also seen those trends in increasing calls to adult protective services for cases of elder abuse or fraud or exploitation. We've actually seen about a 25% uptick every year, almost since the Family Justice Center opened in 2015, when we started tracking those changes in numbers and calls for reports and the role the county plays in protecting older adults.
It's very sobering, Katherine. Tell us what's different about the model that you all are using in Guilford County.
I think collaboration, I've said this many a times, if collaboration was easy, we would have been doing it for a very long time. It makes sense to the public that they could come in one place and access a lot of resources. And it makes sense that one would think that agencies would communicate with each other and work together to help address complex issues. But those things don't happen organically. And I think here in Guilford County, we've made a top priority, and that has come from the board down and our work with the board around collaboration and collaborative solutions where we're going across disciplines and working with the cities and other municipalities to really think collectively about how we want to serve others. And so for us in Guilford, we had the concept of we want to make sure elder abuse is a priority under our Family Justice Center work. We wanted a no wrong door. And we started the collaboration by just saying we're going to meet monthly We're going to try our best to have a meal while we meet, and we're going to start talking about how different agencies are interfacing with older adults and what those needs are. What are they saying they need, and then how can we work collaboratively to address those needs? And I think one of the unique things is often people think you have to have a position and a program to collaborate. And in my opinion, and in 10 years almost of doing this, I think you need a passionate person, and you put a couple of passionate people around the table, you get to know them and build relationships, you can really begin addressing complex challenges that all communities face.
So what was a catalyst for this, Catherine? Was there a particular thing or event that triggered this interest in a collaborative approach to elder abuse interventions, or was it just organic?
Well, from the beginning in the development of the Family Justice Center and our early strategic planning and stakeholder work, we prioritized that we wanted no wrong door. We wanted the youngest to the wisest to be able to walk through one door and get access to services. So that meant we had to make sure our scope was broader than domestic violence, broader than sexual assault, broader than child abuse. So we wanted to make sure that elder abuse was one of those key components. And some of our stakeholders in our early work included Elon's Elder Law Clinic and Corporation of Guardianship and the Area Agency on Aging. And those professionals were sitting at the table, and their job was to advocate to make sure elder abuse didn't fall off the list of priorities. And so I think that the framework of the Family Justice Center created a really nice invitation to looking at how we were doing elder abuse work. Many counties across North Carolina do collaborative work around child abuse. There are child advocacy centers. There's a structure and a framework for that. So we looked at some of those frameworks, but also the framework of the Family Justice Center at large, and said, let's hone in on elder abuse and create an elder justice committee and really make sure that remains a priority in our work.
So Katie, let's turn to the elected official role for just a minute. What was the role of the elected board in developing this different approach to how people handle elder abuse? What was your elected official voice in this whole evolution?
Patrice, from day one, and actually, you know, the Family Justice Center, we were 8 years in the planning process for this center. So it didn't happen overnight. During that time, we had a recession, a lot of things happened. So it gave us a lot of planning time, a lot of time to look at what was going on across the U.S. I was serving on a NACO committee at the time, Justice and Public Safety, and hearing about what others were doing. And as a result of a year-long study on substance abuse as it relates to adolescents and young adults, this idea of a family crisis center or a family justice center came out of that. The commissioners, it was not an easy sell to begin with because, you know, we are talking about stigma here in a lot of areas, particularly when you start talking about domestic violence and abuse within the family. At that time, we'll talk about 10 years ago, a lot of things have changed since. We've gotten a lot of good publicity in the area of mental health, substance abuse, and domestic violence, and brought a lot of that to public acceptance as a talking point. And how do we solve those problems? So bringing the majority voice of the Board of Commissioners on board on that idea was not easy to begin with, of establishing a domestic violence family justice center. As we developed that thought, we were intentional about making it inclusive. We realized that services were available, but they were all siloed across the community. And when someone has a need, Patrice, that person, and I'll direct this comment toward elder abuse specifically. This might be a person 80s, late 80s, et cetera, maybe being attended by a member of the family who is taking their Social Security money. They may not be giving them their medicine, buying their medicine when they should. That person, particularly if they are in more of an isolated area, if you will, doesn't have that contact to be able to create, I need help. Something's going on here. I'm afraid to make a call about it because this is my only resource of help. So we wanted to be sure to pull that area of elder abuse And it was not talked about as much then, nor when we opened our doors in 2015, as it has been in recent years. But we wanted it to be a one-door approach so that if that person had that one chance, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's somebody dropping by, whether it's when they go to the doctor's office, to create an awareness, I need help, something is not right, then we wanted that person to have access to all the services. And we've seen a number of examples where that has happened. So the board wanted the Family Justice Center to be that one door for whatever it is, child abuse all the way to elder abuse. By doing strategic planning and layering on and bringing all of the board members on board, once they got on board, they were on board. There's a lot of stigma about, and throughout the community, about talking about family issues. You know, you want to keep those behind closed doors a lot of times. And we've just got to create more awareness of this and make it more acceptable to say, I need help. I need help, you know, and make it a safe ask for those people. So we were intentional about being totally inclusive. Of course, as we talked about and dreamed of the Family Justice Center and what it would be, you know, we had to make a decision about who was going to lead it. And that's important, very important. And I will tell you that the committee, I actually have chaired this committee from day one. The committee decided that we were going to select the director. We chose Katherine Johnson for many reasons. And my goodness, did we choose the right person? Because we gave her our dream, and she took that vision way beyond anything we ever anticipated. And to think we've served over 75,000 people here since the doors opened, including quite a few elder abuse victims.
Okay. If I could ask you a little bit more about what you're saying. So this committee that you're talking about, is that a committee that was appointed by the Board of Commissioners, or was it a collaboratively appointed?
Well, after the year-long study, this was a recommendation from the study on substance abuse as it relates to adolescents and young adults. We provided some additional services for them. But out of that came the idea that we needed to look at the issue of the whole family and all of the incidents that fall into the area of abuse within a family unit. I brought the idea, and when the chair bought into it, we formed a committee, and two of the commissioners of the original committee are still serving. And we still meet with Katherine off and on. We are the liaisons to that committee. So once they were sold on the idea and they got past the idea of certain time domestic violence, if you were going to go after the perpetrator, it really wasn't the thing to do. You know, that politically, that's not where we're going. So we had to get over that idea. And some said, well, I don't know anybody who, you know, has domestic violence in their family. And I said, well, you do, but you don't know it. You know, and elder abuse is the same thing. You may know people who are experiencing those difficulties, but you just don't know it because they haven't had an opportunity to know. So creating more awareness of that now, I think, both in the medical community, at emergency centers, at the DSS department, in the churches, wherever, and also the EMS department, when they are called to come, I've fallen, I can't get up, you know, to maybe ask a couple of extra questions, to look around and kind of analyze what the situation is and just see. So there are opportunities there for us as well.
Okay, you're raising another interesting point there about not only vulnerabilities, but also awareness of what it means to be abused. What does that actually look like? I've heard that there are older people who might not actually consider something abuse because it's normal behavior to them. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm guessing, Catherine, some of the investigative end of elder abuse comes in. Or how does that happen? If I'm 85 years old and totally dependent on my only child to take care of me, how do I know if that person's behavior is abusive?
Well, and if you're 85 years old, Patrice, you know, you have come from a time where you're dependent upon your family. You know, you may have this thought of, this is just the way it's going to be. I don't have a choice. So that's where we have to depend on outsiders to be more aware. Like when that person goes to the doctor for a checkup, the nurse or the doctor should take an extra look at that person. You know, what was the, what's the attitude of the person who has brought them? Do they appear to be a concerned relative or a concerned helper? Or is this just, okay, you're here for the checkup, period. Be aware of those signs that might also, as I referenced earlier, if they get a call from 911 to come for help, have those EMS people trained to observe and to maybe ask an extra question and to alert DSS that this is a person who seems to need additional help. Let's get the pros in there to take a look. It would be hard for that 85-year-old to pick up the phone and say, my grandson or my nephew or my niece or my daughter is not treating me well, when she knows that's her only resource for the next meal. That's her only help to get to the bathroom. That's her only help to get to the doctor. I think that would be very hesitant. So we have to create more awareness of the across the board community needs that are out there so that we are all advocates for the elderly.
I think Commissioner Cashin makes an excellent point on how significant community is in reducing risk of elder abuse and exploitation. So as she mentioned, you know, we need to screen for that throughout the lifetime. We shouldn't stop asking questions about safety after we don't think someone can bear, is not of childbearing age any longer. And there's been some studies, actually, UNC Chapel Hill did some several years ago around even the medical community not being as direct in screening for issues of elder abuse and safety later in life. Just we have biases and it's ageism around what we believe. And I think the need for community is such an important component. One of the things that our Elder Justice Committee work did very early on is we created a training model that we call Friends Against Fraud. We took all the fraud stats and stories from the sheriff's office and the police department and went to the local consumer credit counseling. And I said, what are the biggest issues? We looked at data that said the number one reason people over 65 call the police is because they've been frauded or scammed. And what happens often with frauds and scams, it's very hard to get the money back, whether it's someone that is related to you or someone who's scamming you from Jamaica. That happens on both ends of the spectrum. So we did some real focused training to senior citizens, went to faith-based communities where seniors were gathering, senior resources. We did some work at several of the residential care communities and really talked to them about how to be a good friend so that if someone you love or you care about is being exploited or scammed or abused, you're aware to those red flags and you can help initiate support for that person. Because Commissioner Cashin's right. I have talked to many older adults in Greensboro who have shared with me in confidence, I was scammed or I was exploited and I never told anyone because I don't want to get in trouble with my daughter. I don't want her to say this was the last straw and now you're going to have to come live with me, mom, because you're not making sound financial decisions anymore. And so we really want to try to build in things that reduce risk. And the number one risk to elder abuse, whether that's sexual abuse, physical abuse, or financial abuse, is isolation. When someone is in isolation, their risk goes way up. So that's a community issue to advocate and address.
So, Catherine, say a little bit more about that connection then. Isolation is a problem for older people. And if I think about some of the points that Katie made, connecting EMS to the medical community or connecting EMS to the Justice Center resources, how do you get the people in the room for all of the people that are in a position to see an elder person in need? How do you get them to collaborate, to share the information, and to know who to call when?
I think one of the things with collaboration, most of us collaborate at the networking level. I give you my card, you give you your card, and now we collaborate. Now I might whip out my desk drawer and rifle through and find your card and call you later. But when we really think about collaboration and what we're doing in our elder abuse work and what we're doing at the Family Justice Center, it's really about enhancing the capacity of our partners. And what I mean by that is they have to see a value in collaborating with us. It has to make the cops' job easier if they're aligning with us. It has to make the EMS job easier, the social work job easier, so that the professional not only knows that it benefits the resident that we're trying to support, but they too receive a benefit from their capacity. They can do more with less. The burdens that they sometimes experience, for example, let's say EMS responds to a house and something doesn't look right, but it's not a criminal issue, so cops aren't going to be called, but that person really needs a social worker to dive in to helping them with their assisted daily living and helping them. Maybe they want to transition from home into residential care. I say those examples in kind of this circular because it's so interconnected, but I think when it comes to the core collaboration, it's creating those relationships and helping people understand not only the value to the public, which is why we all come to work in public service, but also the value to the helper. Both of those things have to be in alignment. And when that happens, people do want to collaborate. I mean, in our elder abuse work, we've done such great work around shared training on really important topics where we're doing multidiscipline. So it may be a law enforcement officer and an APS social worker with Adult Protective Services and a victim advocate who are talking about common issues impacting many people. And we share our expertise with the goal that it's not one person's job. It's our job or all of our jobs working together in alignment.
Thank you, Catherine. Our guests today are Catherine Johnson, of the director of the Family Justice Center in Guilford County, and County Commissioner Katie Cashin. I want to, just before we close, to both of you, see if there is anything that you would like to add that we haven't touched on about your Guilford County Connect to Protect program.
Well, Patrice, I'll go first because I'll go back to the founding of the Family Justice Center, because I think that anyone considering this might also consider our stance from day one. And that was that we wanted this center to be an independent center. We did not want it to fall under any other department, such as DSS, or any other department that had their own initiatives and responsibilities. We wanted this to be an independent one, reporting directly to the manager and the Board of Commissioners. That way, we could give them full support, ongoing support, and we would know what they needed to continue to expand the services throughout. So that's a point that I think is missed a lot of times. And there was a lot of thought about putting it under the Department of Social Services. And we said, no, we want this to be independent of every other. Now, Social Services is a collaborator and a partner in there, of course, as well as EMS, as well as, you know, the Sheriff's Department and the City Police Department and so forth. But it operates as an independent department. When Catherine has needs, she knows we have her back. The commissioners have her back. And she has done an outstanding job. But throughout, this has been a totally intentional, inclusive, service-oriented center in the area of all abuse, whether child abuse to elder abuse. And we're so pleased with where it's been and where it's going. And we're not done yet.
Catherine, closing comments?
I think oftentimes, and I heard this story one time, like, if not me, then who? And I think that quote is such an important quote when it comes to collaboration, because if we're waiting around for someone else to do it, it probably is not going to happen. They may be waiting around for you. And I think that when we think about the complexity of the needs of older adults, and we all have older adults in our lives who are highly valuable, that how do we make sure that from the youngest to the wisest, people can age safely and with grace and dignity? And so the motivation for elder abuse, and I hope every county in North Carolina eventually establishes these multidisciplinary teams, because they do increase the safety and it's worth it. You don't have to have a position. You don't have to have a big budget. You just have to have a couple of passionate people who are going to lean in and say, let's see where this goes. Because if we start by doing the next right thing, then good things will come. So collaboration's worth it. It's not easy, but it's worth it, especially to the citizens and residents of our state.
Thank you, Catherine. I want to thank our amazing studio producer, Paul Bonner, for his work with us today. If you like this podcast, you can like and subscribe to it on our website. We're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. If you have ideas for additional topics, you can reach me at PROESLER@sog.unc.edu. Thank you.